Frozen. This is episode 123. Buttafuoco's Quandary.
Indeed, indeed. Dan and I are together in person for the first time in several months since your 50th birthday, as we were poking around the desert of the real, and here we are in Chicago on a fine Memorial Day weekend, about to go see Torrey Moth. There's an architecture angle for listeners who are interested in this. We're going to the Salt Shed, which is a classic example of a now entire emergent genre of taking public and private large format venues and turn them into music venues. I think of the Post, for example, in Houston, former post office. In this case, it was, in fact, a giant shed for salt that we now go listen to see Torrey Moth, who I'm sure I would love to see if we get closing music. Perhaps we'll play New House by Torrey Moth, my favorite song about the housing crisis. But
featured in one of our episodes, actually.
Indeed, I'll bring that one back. But here we are. But for listeners, you know, we're doing a just the two of us this time special episode while I'm in town. And of course, we have to reflect upon the Biennale because, number one, it's our ongoing obsession slash like foundation story around this whole podcast. But also, Exhibit A, the complete debacle of what happened with the Art Biennale that did not happen on our watch this time. And then also, and this is where Dan has the curatorial statement, the new curators had their formal presentation unveiling the theme of next year's 20th Architecture Biennale. So, Dan, what do we know? What do we got?
Okay.
Break it down.
The title of the new show is Do Architecture for the Possibility of Coexistence Facing a Real Reality.
There have been some real mouthfuls of Biennale themes here, but this might take the cake here. I do like the idea of do architecture, but also, were we not doing architecture before? This is not like a think tank, do tank. Like, we were doing the architecture, not just thinking about it. I mean, most architects think more about the architecture than doing.
Yeah, I think their kind of idea of do, by the way, we should probably say who they are.
Please do.
So the curators are Wang Xu and Liu Wenyu, who are behind Amateur Architecture out of China. Wang Xu was the 2012 Pritzker Prize recipient. They, as a partnership, are known mostly for taking deconstructed, demolished buildings throughout the great Chinese construction boom that have been reassembled into a number of cultural institutions, including the Ningbo Cultural Center and an art school in Hangzhou, most famously, but they have work all over. Yes, this is going to be the first Biennale that is trilingual, recorded and reported and underwritten in Chinese as well as Italian and English. So I don't know if this was the opening salvo of trying to do that, but the press conference was super weird. the two practitioners mainly spoke in Chinese, but they had a kind of dialectic where they were basically, one would start one sentence and then the other would finish the other's sentence. I believe they are a married couple. Doesn't matter. They're partners, and this was the way that they decided to do the presentation, but it was absolute hell for the translators because I think they had one translator assigned to each person. And so it became this absolute word salad of disjointed. I mean, let's just say the AI had a terrible time with it.
It's incredible. We'll put some in the show notes there, but trying to parse their opening presentation of it was absolutely wild in terms of this weird uncanny valley effects. And me being me, of course, what did I try to do? Downloaded the video off YouTube, ran it through Otter, didn't even read what Otter came up with it, dumped it into Claude, and Claude was like, I have no idea what's going on here. So there you go. It's, how make yourself ungovernable. Like, have a Chinese translation there. I do think it's interesting, we'll get back into the themes of here too, but it is very much that as we sort of suspected when they announced the curators, the Biennale is China maxing. I'm going to take my cynical stance here. Last go around with Carlo Rotti was very much a sort of we're going to bring the curatorship back to Italy. Now we're China maxing with this. And also it's interesting because it does apparently fit in with the head of the La Biennale Foundation, sort of tying this into Marco Polo, of course, where we had the recent not the centenary, the 500-year anniversary of polo, 1,000-year. Sorry, I should do more research, listeners, before I get on here.
But in any case, 1300s?
There is a time with polo here where the notion of, like, yeah, Hangzhou is either the beginning or the end of his journey, depending on how you look at it. So that was apparently quoted as a reason they extended the invitation to this curator. So this is an ongoing, very deliberate, multiple timescales, a Italy-China co-production of this one, too. So interesting. All right, so Dan, you did the reading here. What is this going to be about? Because materiality obviously ties in here. It's like, you know, this also struck me as a very Lacaton and vassal. We're all about materials and honest stuff here. But, you know, it's a question of, like, what can we expect here from the 20th edition?
Yeah, the explanation they gave on site was pretty much unintelligible. So I'm just going to read off of a few choice quotes from the actual printed statement. In the face of global climate change, can active and passive approaches to design, strategy, and technology work alongside one another? Can land and architecture coexist? Can more natural materials and local craftsmanship overcome conceptual and technical barriers to stand alongside modern design and construction as their primary components? Can memory and innovation coexist dialectically? Can the efficiency of modern design and construction coexist with slower, more meaningful forms of craftsmanship? So, what I kind of feel from this is something that I feel like we got a sense of at the previous Biennale with the collaboration between Bhutan and the Bjarke Ingels group, with the robot slowly, very carefully brushing up after the handcrafted brick layers.
I mean, hopefully there'll be less ethnic cleansing involved this time. Unlike, yes, the Bjarke Ingels group, Mindfulness City. That one was a particular nadir for me in last year's.
Not to put too fine a point on it.
Yeah, exactly. But it is an interesting theme. But, like, yeah, it is going to be an interesting point of, like, how they carry forward. Again, just like parsing the language and thematics of the Biennales, because I just find this interesting as sort of, you know, architectural world criminology. So we continue the theme of climate change going forward. We're continuing the theme of, like, sort of honest materials. You know, it's not the smart city Biennale of Carlo, but also, it's interesting enough, I keep waiting for, like, the reactionary movement to take us back to, like, pure form. Like, you know, I'm waiting for Aaron Betsky to, like, lead in, like, you know, a bunch of armed gunmen in here to make demand that we focus on shape again. But it doesn't seem like we're going to get that necessarily in this regard.
I think now is probably not the time to do that, given
there's no more time to do any of this. But yeah.
Well, what's happening, lest you be seen to be in cahoots with certain administrations running certain ostensible democracies, building monuments to itself.
I know. There is the subplot here. It's like, what's undetermined, of course. I can't say, as we record this here, that I followed all the various sort of national pavilion competitions moving forward. I am not aware, maybe you are, of who is, like, a finalist for the U.S. pavilion. I've not seen that scuttlebutt. I do know, being a resident of the, you know, Montreal, Canada scene here, like Stefan Novakovic, who we hung out with at the Canada Pavilion Party last year. He's part of a finalist team that wants to examine the border. Just, like, let's look at that big line, folks. And, like, yeah, no time like the present to examine the architecture of that border, huh?
Fair.
So, yeah. So it'll be interesting to see. Because this is where we'll talk about this year's Art Biennale in a moment. But, you know, there was a lot of scuttlebutt ahead of this year's Art Biennale about, like, who's going to represent the Americans? And again, sorry, listeners, I should have done the research beforehand. But I do know that which we'll look up and put in the show notes, that the American contribution of that was widely panned as being completely, not bad, not jingoistic, not anything, but just very inoffensive. And so I'll be very curious to see if we get an inoffensive American pavilion or whatnot. But we'll keep a close eye on that as well, too. Because it was, yeah, Porch, you know, curated last year by the University of Arkansas, and done, of course, with heavy support from the Walton family of Walmart, you know, is beautiful and had a definite elegiac feel. It'll be very interesting to see how that plays out. But yeah, so what else you got from the theme, the curators? Anything else beyond that one? Yeah, a little difficult to parse here.
Gotten really no indications of who they might bring in. But I think if their impetus is really around craftsmanship and trying to do novel things with the sort of the detritus of, you know, generic capital-driven architecture or even state-driven architecture, as the case may be, I think they are going to be looking at, they'll probably be bringing in a lot of people who work at a very close level of detail and a relatively small scale. It will be interesting to see if there's anything like that looks like a master plan or anything that looks like city scale, because I don't know how you translate this theme into that.
Okay, so who would be your picks then? Who do you want to see?
Oh my gosh.
Let's do Fantasy Biennale time.
Oh dear. Man, you really put me on the spot. I mean, there are a lot of people who work at a pretty close level of detail where craftsmanship is important, but totally blanking.
Well, there you go. Well, I don't know. I'm just thinking in terms of like sort of the reuse aspect and materiality. So, is where it's at. So Lacaton and Vassal, Jean-Philippe Vassal and Anne Lacaton, Pritzker Prize winners in 21.
Sure.
And then the other one strikes out. And these of course have all been participants in just the last couple. Is also, please pardon my non-French pronunciation here, of Debedo Francis Carey, who won in 2022. I think we saw last go round. At least we saw he was definitely in Leslie Loco's Laboratory of the Future. And I could see those in there as sort of major participants. It'll be curious to see like who the heroes this will be. And then the obvious question is like, how much of a China Biennale will this be? You know, what will we get? I mean, it doesn't seem like Ma Yansong fits quite with the theme, but you know, will they be pulling strings here to bring in a lot of Chinese practitioners? How will the geopolitics of this work is going to be a really interesting question.
It's a good question. I can't think of anybody who's working in the sort of the same idiom as like Wangshu. You know, there's Ai Weiwei, but he's kind of more of an artist and he's kind of still, I think, pretty much blacklisted by China. So yeah, other than that, everyone else is kind of more on the oppositional side of what they seem to be objecting to, which is this sort of mega architecture of recent decades. It would be interesting to see. Maybe we'll be bringing in some people who are doing reparative sort of architecture in places that are, say, war-torn. That would be interesting to see. Like anybody who's doing some of the work following the destruction in Ukraine, for example. there are some really interesting people working there now. So I would expect to perhaps see some of that.
Well, that chortle of mine just now, it sets up as a good segue here to this year's Art Biennale, in terms of what we can also expect for next year. So listeners, you've been following what's been happening on the ground in Venice the last couple of weeks. So my advice to the curators of next year's Biennale, number one, don't die. That's the top thing to take away. Because, of course, that was the tragedy that befell this year's Art Biennale, where the curator, Koyo Kuo, died untimely, like basically a year ago now, just shortly after her appointment, after she had set the theme and presented it. And so, she put a team of her assistants in place to help guide it through. But that's when things started going off the rails this year. Just to quickly recap, for the last few years, both the Russian pavilion and the Israeli pavilions have been dark. I believe the Biennale state of point of view is that the nations, certainly the Russians, own their pavilion. And I believe the bylaws of the Biennale say that if you are recognized by the government of Italy, you are permitted to exhibit if you secure a venue. So, until now, the Russians and the Israelis had perhaps the good taste, shall we say, to simply not make their presences felt. Last time we were there, like, the Russian pavilion was halfway turned over to Thomas Heatherwick for some education sessions, and the Israeli pavilion in the Giardini was under renovation. But this year they are back, and things went off the rails, where the jury awarding the Golden Lion refused to grant awards, to grant a Golden Lion to anybody under investigation by the ICC, the International Criminal Court. Some people criticize them for not including the United States in that one, which also fun. Which doesn't
recognize the jurisdiction.
Yeah, exactly. ICC. I'm not sure Israel does either, but hey, that doesn't stop anybody. But then, of course, the jurors resigned en masse. I've seen news reports alleging that the Israeli pavilion curator threatened to sue them. The Biennale did not support them, which of course would have opened up to individual legal action, so they just resigned. And then in attempts to do a sort of crowdsourced voting, Golden Lion fell apart when like 80 plus artists also pulled out. So this is all going on here. And to me, this is all very interesting because, you know, the Art Biennale matters. Like, there's a reason this didn't happen in 23 or 25 at the architecture Biennales. But if the Art Biennale matters more, it's where we're going to make these kinds of statements, it's the architecture Biennale where this actually gets back to the thematic material of rebuilding. We did not see it in Venice. I saw it last fall in Milan at the Design Triennale, where Norman Foster's group that has been doing elaborate research into the reconstruction of Ukraine post-war presented their results. And so we could definitely see here, I'd be curious to see if the Israel and Russian pavilions really come out guns blazing with Make Gaza Great Again, for example, or what Russia wants to do in the Donbass. I don't know. And then we can imagine sort of counter protests, sort of like showing utopian schemes of what should arise. But yeah, it'll be contested there. But yeah, it's been quite a time. And you know, and the Biennale has been buffeted. The EU hates the fact that Russia is there. The Italian government hates the fact that Russia is there. I'm very curious to see what turns out then. But yeah, I think about this there. We're like, you know, what kind of activations we'll see. I'm working on my own, Dan. I don't think I've told you about this.
What are you activating, Greg?
Well, I work on this. So my, you know, so our my friend and sometimes creative partner, Michelle Champagne, who listeners will remember, I believe, from episodes 99 and 100 when we were back in Venice. She and I are working on an idea that we're calling the European-Canadian Alliance, abbreviated to the EU-Can Alliance, which you know how it's pronounced.
You can
Alliance here. And, you know, I imagine this course is a sort of, you know, classic OMA, AMO content, countryside the future, like shitpost there kind of thing. But Michelle, God bless her, has, you know, yeah, was working out an idea of creating actual a sort of cultural alliance around housing and tying into the new Bauhaus proposals. And, you know, she's probably right. But this idea is we're trying to think about, like, who, you know, what can we do as sort of a way to tie in the geopolitics, to think about how to ground it in architecture and use it. And this, where listeners, if you can be of help to me, is where I reveal that I have the exclusive first right of refusal on booking Mind Enterprises, the Italo disco DJs who are in all the memes of, like, hey, Euromaxing, where they're pouring Campari spritzes for themselves and like blissfully DJing. Oh yeah, I've got first right refusal on booking them for our Biennale party. So if you listeners got a you know, pavilion opening in mind, we're available here for the UCAN Alliance opener, your pavilion. Dan's looking at me in disbelief. It's true. I actually reached out to the representation in Italy, and yeah, I've got first dibs.
I'm ready to pour now. I mean, that's fantastic. I can't wait.
There you go. Well, we'll see if it comes to that one there too. But yeah, it will be, it's an interesting setup here for another year out, like where we end up from here in terms of just the ongoing thing. I mean, I think about this because, like, India had its first pavilion in 7 years. The Iranian pavilion could be very lit next year. I think it's interesting about, like, what the Biennale is for in this regard of, like, this idea that it's like, oh, it's, you know, it's multi, you know, I don't know, but some sort of soft globalism or showing this. Yeah, you know, the Biennale, Foundation has been trying to take this really weak line here about, like, we're welcome to everybody. But, like, I kind of like the idea. If we're going to talk about this as, you know, the lazy line that this is the Olympics of the art world and sort of the architectural world, then, yeah, let's dial up the geopolitical, like, you know, like, trash talking by other means. That's where I'm at.
Yeah, that's tough because on the one hand, you do, you know, I think it's fair to say that I've been surprised by a lot of the pavilions that have been staged by countries that you would think would have extremely authoritarian governments that would want to control the narrative. And yet the pavilions were very eye-opening, maybe because there's more to those places than we're led to believe in news media or whatever. Like, you know, Saudi Arabia always has an excellent, excellent pavilion. And you would...
Yes.
The default assumption would be that it would be some kind of grandiose,
yeah,
you know, pro-statist kind of thing.
Which in 23 was the off-site neon pavilion.
Okay, that happened, yeah, yeah. But that was neon.
I know. And that goes back to, like, I think, the heart of, like, the jury processes that are the heart of these pavilion selections, where so there is that.
To me, though, I would feel badly if, like, there was a great Russian or Israeli architect who had something to say and they were prevented from being at the Biennale and being able to say it because their country is stupid.
I mean, totally agree.
Likewise, because I fully expect people to make the argument that America should be banned. I don't expect it to have any teeth, but they could. They could easily, on the same grounds, accuse us of warmongering and everything else. But then what would fill the content? Like,
I would say, for the record, I'm in favor of the Biennale's position of, like, you should have the pavilions there and you should have to do it. I mean, yeah, it would be interesting to see in a world that we live in now where slopaganda defines anything. It would be crazy to see if, like, there's, like, some insane American slopaganda pavilion or something else in this regard versus these tasteful ones. Cause, like, yeah, I mean, you're totally right. I mean, yeah, what I would love to see. So, you know, my friend Rafi Siegel saw, you know, we had Rafi, you know, episode 100 there. I mean, you know, we'll put in the show notes the Michael Sorkin blistering piece about how Rafi was awarded the Israeli National Library and then had it stripped from him because of the political path Israel is on, one could say, kind of thing. And so, yeah, so I mean, I would love to see, you know, these kinds of artists inside of that one. I could take off one hand at least the number of Russian architects I would love to see the Russian pavilion, or counter program a Russian pavilion would be great too, which is, again, like, you know, I want to see how this goes. I also just note, listeners, you know, not to put any idea in anybody's heads there, but like, you know, there is right outside the gates, outside the Russian pavilion, is like an open clearing that you could, like, you know, occupy for a while. It's like not in the Biennale grounds, but I'm just saying there's lots of sites.
Sub Rosa, potential protest location.
Yeah, exactly. It's free real estate. So, you know, you gotta get out there and do that. But yeah, I mean, I hope we'll see that. You know, if the Qataris could buy a pavilion site in the Giardini, which they have done, and they're there again, like, you know, it'd be interesting to see. So yeah, so that's part of my project. If we continue with this You Can alliance, you know, at least want to do some XR pavilions. You know, I toyed with the idea that we should drop it on top of the Russian pavilion, but no, we'll find our own spot, I think.
That might be a little on the nose.
Might be a little on the nose there. But it also brings me back. I was like, I'll be curious to see also what the pushback on the Biennale Foundation will be. I think one of my favorite pavilions in recent years was when the Austrians tried to build a bridge over the wall to allow residents of Santa Elena in. And as someone who spent time in Venice, and we'll come back to Venice residents in a moment here before we conclude, you know, I think it would have been great to like just allow Venetians to just like climb over like the Berlin Wall of sorts into the Biennale and spill forth and drink spritzes with the rest of us.
The symbolism was rife.
Yeah, there you go. All right, well, last note here. So in other Venetian news, because it's all I think about all the time, is, you know, listeners will remember, like, I'm a giant fan in late life of Venezia FC, which I was trying to work on a project with. But Venezia FC has been promoted back to Serie A, the top flight of Italian soccer, which matters because, you know, global football is mostly a matter of television money, which is commanded by the top leagues. And so it is a big deal to be up there. The richest sporting match in the world, Dan, if you know this, is over in England. It just concluded with Hull City winning it. It is the promotion playoff final to the Premier League, where basically if you win, you get $200 million in television rights as your share of the Premier League. God. So it changes the whole economics of the club. So Venezia FC is going back up. But what's really interesting is a couple things. So they are opening, they're still on schedule to open their new arena on the mainland in Mestre, which is where, you know, their team colors are Arancio Nero Verde, orange, black, and green. The Arancio comes from the Mestre team. And it's interesting because, well, several things. So that stadium, they put out a survey to the fans, of which I'm one, because I attended a game there with the boys last fall. And yes, questions, Dan, on there like, what other events of these do you attend? Formula One, any race? The World Economic Forum. That was when it stood out. I was like, what other sporting franchise asks their fans if they happen to attend Davos? But well, the answer to that question, I will answer that. It's Como, which is the other hotness up in Serie A, which is the team on Lake Como with the stadium on the water.
I was about to ask.
Owned by a pair of Indonesian tobacco billionaire brothers. That's the kind of money it takes, which is what segue here is because days after Venezia won its promotion and to ecstatic celebration in the city with parades on the water and the boats, beautiful signage, they announced that basically Drake has taken over the team. Yes, Drake, Toronto Drake.
That Drake,
who had invested $10 million at the behest of the ownership group, I believe two seasons ago. And now they have this works here where he basically has installed, and I do not have the name in front of me, has installed the former sort of maestro of Toronto FC and other sort of sporting ventures, who was indicted by the U.S. Department of Justice for bid rigging for a new stadium for the University of Texas and then was granted a pardon by President Trump. He will take over as vice chairman of the club, and his daughter has been installed in president. And the ownership group, which includes a former head of the New York Stock Exchange, which I guess is just not enough money, is bowing out. And the new ownership group, new leadership group, is investing 100 million euros. I bring all this up because this harkens back to Paul Goldberger, I think back in 119, where Paul was talking at the end about writing another book about football stadia. And this is where it intersects with culture, geopolitics, global capital. I think it's wild that, like, basically a bunch of Canadians from Toronto are now running my adopted team in Venezia. Which, you know, just shows that I can't, like, outrun my own, like, lameness here of being in Canada, I guess, you know. And it's also interesting because Giuseppe Buttafuoco, that's a joke, because Pierangelo Buttafuoco is the head of the Biennale Foundation, as we were joking there. No, it's Giuseppe Saputo, who's known as Joey in Montreal, his family basically runs the giant dairy empire in Quebec. They own Bologna. And so it's really interesting how this all plays out. And as a final note, I'll tie into this one too, as the World Cup is about to start on us, where this all ties back together, it is interesting where like FIFA has incredibly stringent demands on all of its host cities. Montreal finally went public with why it rejected the process from the beginning, is because FIFA would require them, given its exclusivity clauses, to cancel both Formula One and Jazz Fest, to which Montreal was like, LOL, no.
Forget it.
So it is interesting. Yeah, again, sport, culture, Chicago, architecture, by the way, similar deal.
Pride.
Yes.
It down too.
Chicago was, I think, one of the first cities to come out and say, like, this is the stupidest contract we've ever seen.
And that's saying something because we accepted NASCAR.
That's true. And also the Bears are still also like being like, well, we've exhausted our options for a stadium in Chicago. We're going to end up in Arlington Heights or Hammond, Indiana, to which I just, the collective eye rolling by every Illinois resident, the idea of like, you're going to go to Rust Belt, Indiana for this. Like, sure, you can. We'll see. But perhaps we'll be back with a future episode of that one too. But it is interesting. But like, yes, so I bring this up, Dan, to tie us back in a bow, is that a year from now, during the vernissage of May 7th, 8th, I believe. No, sorry, May 6th, 7th, the vernissage for next year's Biennale. That weekend, perhaps maybe the last game of football, of top flight men's football ever played in Lagoon at Pierluigi Penzo before they move to their new arena on the mainland, where they will try to maximize this revenue. And it's gonna be quite a time.
Something tells me you're gonna be there.
Something tells me I'm gonna be there. It'll be my 50th birthday. We'll be recording this podcast my 50th then, with probably even more guest stars. If you thought last year was crazy, listeners, we'll have even more. There you go. More kitchen podcasting at 2 a.m. I can't wait.
Oh yes, you can. See what I did there?